Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. It seems more and more likely that a Nebraska death row inmate will die by lethal injection next Tuesday, August 14th. An attorney for condemned killer Kerry Dean Moore said yesterday that the execution is expected to take place as scheduled. The Nebraska Supreme Court yesterday promptly overruled a motion filed by Moore's defense lawyer asking to withdraw from representing the 60-year-old inmate. Moore says he wants to die Tuesday in the state's first lethal injection execution. There have been ongoing protests against the execution. However, a majority of Nebraskans voted to bring back the death penalty in a constitutional referendum last year. Moore was convicted and condemned for the deaths of Omaha cab drivers Raoul Van Ness and Maynard Helgeland. Nebraska's last execution took place in 1997 when the method was the electric chair. Marion Fellian is one of the protesters who wants to stop that execution. She stood with around 20 protesters in front of the largely empty governor's mansion that sits across the street from the unicameral. Cars keep rolling by, some honking and some folks just staring. Fellian has a long history of opposing the death penalty. She was a spiritual advisor to the last person who was executed in Nebraska. Robert Williams was executed in 1997 for murdering three women and trying to kill a fourth during a three-day, three-state rampage in 1997. Two were from Lincoln, one was from Sioux Rapids, and one woman that survived was from Minnesota. Despite Williams' vicious crimes, Fellian says the experience of watching him die has left an indelible mark on her views of life, death, and justice.
I have often said, I think most people are good people, and most people, had they had that experience, would be as opposed to the death penalty as I am. The big thing that I took away from that is what it says about us. It says more about us than it does about the person in the death chamber. When we as a state decide to kill one of our citizens.
While many Nebraskans disagree with her, Marilyn says she believes the act of executing someone is just as bad, if not worse, than the original murders that were committed.
If we know that this person did something that was awful, now we're going to imitate that behavior and do the same thing, except even worse, because first of all, he's tied down and rendered completely defenseless. What does that say about us, that it's all right to do that?
Are you also concerned about the use of the drugs?
Very, very concerned.
It doesn't seem like they're really sure what's going to happen with them.
Well, no, they've never been tried before. This particular cocktail has never been, and if you want to talk to somebody who really knows about that, talk to this fellow. This is Matt Molly. He coordinates the Nebraskans for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
These chemicals, this is the first time this particular mix of chemicals is going to be used. People are very concerned because they don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I mean, this is, they're just experimenting with these drugs. They've never been done before in an execution in this combination, which is a scary thing to anybody, I think, who, this is a serious process. There's no room for experimentation. There's no room for error. And regardless of what you think about capital punishment as a policy, nobody wants this to be botched. And this has happened in other states when they, go to less and less ideal drugs because they can't get the drugs that they know work. So this is a huge problem, and we don't really know what's going to happen. But this is not good government to be experimenting with somebody's life like this.
You talk about alternatives to the death penalty. What are some alternatives you think would be applicable to especially someone who's killed a couple of people? People are saying, well, they're not being punished, or they're afraid they'll get out. From what I've seen, in statistics, not that many people actually escape.
Oh, not at all. The alternative is simple. It's life without the possibility of parole. In Nebraska, if your sentence is life, you will never, ever come before a parole board. They'll spend the rest of their lives in prison where they pose no danger to society. That's just a better policy in every way. It can save taxpayers millions and millions of dollars. It's easier on victims' families. They can just serve their life sentence anonymously, and the victims can more or less forget about them and try to honor the victim, which is what really is important. It's easier on correctional officers. And of course, if we make a mistake, as we so often do, you can release someone from a prison cell. You can't release them from the grave. So we've had over 160 innocent people exonerated from death row for crimes they didn't commit. Coming from a pro-life perspective myself, as many Nebraskans do, that's a pretty horrifying thought, to the idea of possibly killing the wrong person.
I asked Marion Fellian what she thought of the argument that murderers could escape and kill others, or even kill others in prison, so it was only logical that they need to be killed before they can do more harm.
Studies have shown that the states that have abolished the death penalty have fewer murders than the states that contain the death penalty. There's something about the mindset of a people in a state, a recognition that all life is sacred, and so people are safer in the states that do not have a death penalty.
I know the Pope has come out even stronger against the death penalty. Do you think this helps your cause?
I think it will. I don't expect it to change the governor's mind, unfortunately, but who knows who else somewhere along the chain, some judge or some of the people involved with the sale of the drugs and that sort of thing, who knows what might happen because of the Pope's statement. So I continue to be hopeful.
Well, he's Catholic, isn't he? I mean, his father just built that big center out there.
Yes, he's Catholic, and up to this point he has stood behind the church's teaching on the death penalty because it allowed just a little bit of wiggle room. Now that wiggle room is gone, so he does not have church teaching to stand behind anymore. He doesn't have that.
What kind of reaction do you get from people who walk by? Does anyone come up and talk to you?
Well, we've had what I call happy honks and waves and that sort of thing. So I think people are with us, maybe more than we know.
Father Damien Zerling was also part of the protest group in Lincoln. Father Zerling is the pastor at St. Francis Cabrini Parish in Omaha. The priest said he hoped that the Holy Father had succeeded in removing any doubts that capital punishment is wrong in the eyes of the church.
In the past, there's always been this little loophole that if you couldn't protect society in some way, so some people I know very well would say, well, you have to have the death penalty because this guy might kill somebody in prison. And unless you can protect the other prisoners, then you need to make sure he can't do that. So there was always that little loophole, and the Pope has removed the loophole and just said, no, yeah, there's you figure out a way to protect everybody, but you don't have to take a life to do that. So it gets rid of the loophole.
Well, and the governor is Catholic, his father is Catholic. Do you think it will affect his conscience?
Well, I would hope so, that he has to examine it a little more thoroughly, and he just can't say, well, I'm going to go with the loophole here, because that's gone now. So now he has to fully look at it. I think he has to look at the example he's giving to young people in the state to say, well, even though something you believe in teaches this, and then you choose to, you can just disagree. So how do you do it? You're teaching them to be disobedient. So the governor is teaching young people to be disobedient to their essentials of their faith. I don't think that's a good example.
Aside from all the moral questions and fears over the effects of the untried drug combination, Marilyn Fellian says she's concerned about the prison personnel. They have to carry out the state-ordered executions.
One of the things that I experienced when I accompanied Robert Williams is how hard this is on prison personnel. The six big guards that escorted Robert to the death chamber, when I went past them to go to the witness room, they were sobbing. People don't have any idea how hard this is. And more there are wardens and prison people across the country who are coming out and talking about the nightmares and the night terrors and the PTSD and the alcoholism that have followed when they have had to, in a deliberate and cold-blooded and premeditated manner, kill a human being that they have first tied down and rendered defenseless. Let alone this person has been defenseless in a cell for how many years. And then to take him out and tie him down, strap him down so he can't respond, and then kill him is not something that it's not in our DNA to do that.
Fran Kay stood near the road with her friends, who have been joining together to protest the death penalty for more than 20 years. Fran said she was heartened when the state legislature repealed the death penalty in Nebraska back in 2015. However, Nebraskans voted overwhelmingly to bring back the death penalty by a statewide constitutional referendum last year.
I come here very regularly. We've had this vigil since 1991. Sitaram and I have been coming with her son for most of last year. We also leafleted on the UNL campus during the referendum. So we're actually touching people, but there don't seem to be enough people who are willing to listen.
Were you surprised when the death penalty made a comeback?
No, we knew from leafleting that we were in trouble. We leafleted one football Saturday, and it was perfectly clear that Nebraskans didn't want to hear about it. It wasn't that they were strongly in favor of a death penalty. It was that they thought that killing people was a good idea, and they didn't want to hear anything about it. And they really didn't want to listen to us. It was too disturbing to them to think that they might be wrong.
Jean Eden says she began protesting the death penalty back in the early 1990s, but then she moved away from Nebraska. Jean says she moved back to Omaha and decided to join this latest movement.
I don't know. I was doing it back in the early 90s when they were going to execute Willie Otey. And I didn't keep it up because I moved away, but I still believe killing people is wrong, and having a death penalty really distorts the criminal justice system. It makes it not work appropriately, and it doesn't do any good.
Why do you think the people of Nebraska aren't willing to let go of the death penalty ultimately?
Misinformation, I suppose. Just not knowing enough, I guess, because from what I know, it does not help anything. And we make decisions that really only God can make about who's going to live and who's going to die.
Cars continually drive by the protesters in front of the governor's mansion in Lincoln, and many of them give the group an encouraging honk and a wave. Juanita Rice says she always waves back.
This is a different voter profile than maybe those who voted for it. You know, giving us the thumbs up, smiles, waving, honking. Didn't know. I've been away from Nebraska for a long time. So I'm always a little apprehensive about, well, for instance, that my car gets keyed because of my Nebraskans for Peace sticker. So support is wonderful. Support is wonderful.
Sheila Burke of Omaha says she has a hard time thinking that she or anyone else will be relieved when and if Carrie Dean Moore is executed next Tuesday.
You know, the thought came to me that if this man is executed on August 14th, will we wake up on August 15th and find that our lives are better because we've killed him? It's hard for me to see how that's going to make anybody's life any better. The family of one of the people that he killed, you know, said it isn't going to make him feel any better. You know, I mean, it isn't going to bring his father, isn't going to bring him back. You know, so many oftentimes the families will say, well, we'll get closure. But, you know, what do you really get from that? it seems to me that if you accept that your loved one is gone and learn how it is that one lives with that awful loss, rather than holding out the hope that if I can just do something to him, then I'll feel better. I don't suspect that that really helps very much.
Despite the bad news about the likelihood of the execution next Tuesday, Mary Harm says she comes here almost every day, and she feels like it gives her hope. Are you a longtime opponent of the death penalty?
I'm a longtime opponent, yes. I have a young son who supports me in doing this, encouraged me to start doing this.
Do you feel like you guys have influenced some people being out here?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I put the signs in my yard, I put the signs in my car when I'm at the office, and it's affecting people. I'm getting conversations with multiple people.
Perhaps the only remaining avenue to delay the execution would be a lawsuit by pharmaceutical manufacturers who produce drugs Nebraska plans to use. Three companies have sent letters to state officials asking for the return of their drugs if the state has them, but officials have ignored their demands. A similar lawsuit by a drug company last month prompted a judge to order an execution delay in Nevada. The state of Nebraska hasn't used capital punishment since 1997, when Nebraska's method of execution was still the electric chair. The state Supreme Court has since declared electrocution cruel and unusual punishment in violation of the Constitution. Between now and the date of the execution, the protesters will continue to gather outside the governor's mansion every day between noon and 1. And on Tuesday, between 5 and 6 p.m., during the time the execution may be carried out, the group will gather in front of the governor's mansion once again for a rally for peace and justice. Marion Fellian remains hopeful that they will be able to bring about change when it comes to the death penalty in Nebraska. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, one man says he'll have no regrets if Kerry Dean Moore is executed next Tuesday. Republican Nebraska lawmaker Mike Groney worked hard to help get the word out about the constitutional referendum that brought back the death penalty in 2018. The legislature had repealed the death penalty back in 2015. Groney says despite all of the press over those opposed to the death penalty in Nebraska, he is actually one of the 71% of citizens who voted to bring the death penalty back.
You've got to remember, I'm not the oddball. We're talking about 10,000 years of human history, biblically and whatever you want to call it, where it was common practice to punish evil with the death penalty. The oddballs are the ones who want to change the history of civilization, not me. And it's not about vengeance, and it's not a biblical, it's not about get even, it's about justice. It's about, it's what I told the reporter from the World Herald, but you didn't put in there. I've been in probably 80% of all the small towns. I grew up in a small town in Nebraska. I travel west, rural Kansas and Colorado. And I could go up to anybody in their 60s or 70s and ask them, In the town's history, has there been a violent crime that in your lifetime? And every one of them will say yes. Everyone. Everyone has a community knowledge or memory of evil happening in their community. And in a civilized society, those people sport the death penalty not because they want to get vengeance. They want to be protected by the leaders in their society. They want to live a life not in fear. That is why people support the death penalty. Not about what happened in Norfolk at the bank. It's not about what this guy is going to be executed on the 14th. It's about their own collective memory of about confronting evil in a civilized society. That's why you have the death penalty. Simple as that.
Do you feel like the, you know, the specifications of who gets the death penalty are what they should be?
Premeditated, period. That's a simple definition. Premeditated murder, or if you shoot a police officer, a public service service person, a fireman or a police officer. That's my guideline. You got to have guidelines. And that's why the police know support the death penalty. Because they know if they walk into a burglary at the Quick Stop, they know that the guy knows he's already shot the clerk and he could probably get life in prison. But if he shoots the cop, he gets the death penalty. You take that away, now the criminal says, hey, if I shoot the cop, I still get life imprisonment. And if I shoot him, I got a chance to escape. I've already killed one person. Why not two and get away? That's how simple it is. And police officers know that. They want to be protected. We protect our public servants.
Do you think there's a great chance of people escaping?
I don't know. But I do know I do know generations change. And collective memory goes away when somebody was 25 and they did a violent crime, and then it's 40 years later, and the generation that was there, the older generation that put them in life imprisonment, are replaced by a younger one who don't. All they see is an old gentleman in the prison, and they decide to let him go, but he hasn't changed. That penalty makes it final. Person gets punished by the generation that he committed a crime against. That's simple as that.
Do you think that when people, you know, sit on death row for, 20 years, it seems like, do you think is it harder for, is it more of a punishment for them, or does it just keep giving them more of an opportunity to sort of avoid the death penalty?
To get out. Give them more of an opportunity to avoid it. And remember, it's not about them. And this whole debate, it's always been about that poor guy who committed murder and been put to death. Remember why he's there. There are families grieving, lost their loved ones, and we worry about the guy, the self-centered jerk who killed them people. Think about it. What's wrong with our society when we forget the victims? Here's my about freedom in America. Either you have it or you don't. I will go to sleep easily on August 13th, and I will wake up fine on August 14th, and I'll go to bed on August 14th and sleep fine. Because, see, I didn't decide to put that person to death. He did. He knew in a free society that if he murdered somebody premeditated, he would face the death penalty. So this guy decided, I want to be put to death. Did he not? When he committed the crime, he decided he wanted to be put to death. He made the choice. Free choice. Not at me.
Do you hear a lot from people who are opposed to the death penalty? Are you someone that they contact or talk about?
They know better than they're not going to change Grony's mind. I mean, I got a lot of North Platte's full of Catholics, St. Pat's, Irish Catholics. I was raised Catholic. They understand. Most of them don't agree with some of the bishops. They understand what the Bible says, religion-wise. It's you punish evil. If your religious belief is that religion is about the flesh, then you're probably against the death penalty. If your religion is about the soul that lives in the tent of the flesh, you're probably for the death penalty. But if you think the flesh and living 70 years, when it's a blink of eternity, when somebody's put to death if they're 30 or 70, and you think that's a big deal, then you don't understand religion. That guy made his choice. He committed a violent crime, premeditated, and he wanted the state to put him to death. If that's not the case, then nobody in this country is responsible for themselves or their actions. And then we want bigger government who says, no, you're not responsible for what you do. Government is. And we will take care of you. Either you believe in personal responsibility, personal freedom to make decisions and bear the consequences, or you don't.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, most of us, the overwhelming huge majority of Americans would never be in that situation.
Mm. Oh, yeah. But you could be
right.
a victim of that
right.
person. You could easily be a victim of that person. I can't think of any of that Jenkins guy. That was a young lady walking down the street in the middle of the day in a suburb, and he pulled up and shot her. Now, are you going to worry about Mr. Jenkins? That whole family has been disrupted every Christmas, every get-together. But we worry about Mr. Jenkins? He made that choice. She did not make that choice. She, just like an unborn baby, did not make that choice to die, did she? So the people who say pro-choice, against abortion, shouldn't be against the death penalty, bull. I want that child to decide if they want to live or die. I want that Jenkins to decide that he decided already when he did that crime that he wanted to die. He made that choice. So that argument about pro-life versus death penalty doesn't hold water with me. I'm actually, you reverse it, pro-choice. I want that baby to be able to decide if they want to live or die. I want that man, Jenkins, to decide if he wants to live or die. And he decided that when he pulled up and shot that lady right on the street in the middle of an afternoon. That guy, those people who shot those people in that bank in North Platte, in Norfolk, decided they wanted to die at that minute when they did it. Not me. They did.
That was Republican Nebraska State Senator Mike Groney. He represents District 42 in North Platte, in the western part of the state. Groney is a staunch supporter of the death penalty, and he was talking about the upcoming execution of Gary Dean Moore next Tuesday, August 14th. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Next Friday, healthcare providers, teachers, and others will meet in Sioux City for a conference on dealing with trauma. Building Trauma-Informed Communities is a regional summit that will take place at Sunnybrook Community Church from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. next Friday. The event will deal with several issues, including trauma effects on the brain, self-care for providers, culture and poverty, and human trafficking. Dr. Natalie Sandbolt is the Vice President of Clinical Services at Seasons Center for Behavioral Health in Spencer, the organization that's putting together the conference. Sandbolt says sometimes it is hard to know if a grown-up or a child has experienced trauma, and teachers and healthcare providers aren't sure what to do.
Yeah, well, a lot of the kids that we work with at Seasons Center have histories of trauma, and what we have noticed is that they often get misdiagnosed. They might get labeled as the naughty kid, or they get sort of an alphabet soup variety of different diagnoses, and when in reality they're reacting to past trauma, and they need to be treated very differently than a child who's purely defiant or a child who may have an organic type of attention deficit disorder. And so, and research has shown us this too. The ACEs study adverse childhood experiences has been huge in helping people to understand the impact, not only psychologically, but also physically, of trauma on kids as they continue to grow and age and make life choices for themselves. And so we really feel very passionately about educating the community about what trauma looks like in kids so that we can understand it and intervene earlier in the hopes of building in some protective factors, some resources, some resilience for these kids to try to give them a different outcome than what they experienced or what their parents may have experienced.
You know, it really sounds like it can be a lot of things, and it can also be ongoing.
Absolutely. There's a difference between acute trauma and complex trauma, so I'm glad you brought that up. And, you know, acute trauma, if people have a pretty stable environment and supportive people in their life, they usually bounce back from that pretty well. But complex trauma is kind of a whole different beast, and it can be ongoing. It can be from multiple different places. It can even begin in utero if the child is exposed to substances in utero, or if the mother is under a lot of stress and is passing those stress hormones right on to her baby. That can definitely impact the way a child's brain is developing. So this is complex trauma is what we're talking about really here, where you've just got multiple issues that are coming at this child.
So the people attending this event, will they be healthcare providers, mental health providers, educators?
Absolutely. That's our hope. Those are the communities that we've tried to reach out to because they're, you know, kids need people in all these different areas of their lives to see this and to intervene, because each person that acts as a support or that stands up for this child or that says, you know, let's look at this a different way, that's one more point, so to speak, in that child's favor for them to do well and to build those skills and resources to become resilient.
I noticed Sister Shirley Finneran of Briarcliff University is going to be coming in and talking about human trafficking.
She is, and I personally have never heard her speak before, so I'm really looking forward to that. I know other members of our staff have heard her speak and said she just does a fabulous job. So, you know, that would be definitely another area of trauma, and of course something that is just in the hot spotlight right now all over the state.
What do you hope people come away with from this conference?
I'm really hoping that they will leave with an increased knowledge and awareness of what trauma might look like in a child. Every child is unique, but I'm hoping that it will give them a new perspective when they're working with a difficult child or a child who's struggling to learn new things. I'm hoping they'll think twice about why that child might be struggling and to really shift their perception and maybe be able to do something in a way that they wouldn't have previously to help that child get the help and the resources that they need. So I'm really hoping that it's an awareness and a shift in perspective.
That was Dr. Natalie Sandbolt of the Season Center for Behavioral Health in Spencer. The center is putting together the conference Building Trauma-Informed Communities next Friday, August 17th at Sunnybrook Community Church in Sioux City. Human trafficking and the trauma that results from it will be one of the areas addressed at the conference. Sister Shirley Finneran is the Director of Field Education at Briarcliff University and a board member of the Siouxland Coalition Against Human Trafficking. Finneran says she will be giving a broad-based presentation on sex trafficking so people will be able to know what it is when they see it.
So I'm going to be talking about human trafficking mostly. More about sex trafficking than labor trafficking, and we'll be talking about how trauma affects the victims, and we'll be just doing some general education about human trafficking, and then also talking about Lila May's house that we are starting.
Now, Lila May's house, I remember you talking about this, boy, almost 2 years ago, and how you were getting the ball rolling. How is that going?
Well, it's the renovation is almost finished, and I'm still trying to raise money, and so my next big effort for raising money will be hopefully to hire staff. So we did hire a house manager for a while when we thought we were going to, you know, move ahead a little faster and to have one in there. But we are not at that point. And so I don't have any staff on board right now. I hope to have been open already, you know, this year, but God's plan and mine aren't the same for the timeline. So I have to go with what the amount of money that I'm able to raise in the time. So, so we've enlarged our board of directors, hopefully we'll be doing some more, fundraising. But so part of it really hinges on, you know, having enough money to really do what we need to do.
When I look back at the last couple of years, it does seem like there's been a lot of progress in raising awareness.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So last year, I talked to over 2,000 people, just myself, and I really haven't tallied my numbers this year yet. But yeah, but it's still, you know, people are still unaware, and some people hear about it, but they still don't necessarily think it's in our communities, but it absolutely is, both labor and sex trafficking. But the awareness is increasing. So 2 weeks ago, another person and I trained the Sioux City Emergency Medical Services employees, and so that was really helpful to them in giving them some information of what to look for when they go out on the emergency calls, because they're going to often see, you know, a person who may have been, you know, beaten or something is wrong. So medical, it's important to train medical staff, because most people who are trafficked will see a medical personnel at least once while they're being trafficked. And so it's important that they know what to watch for as well. So we do some of that as well. So, yeah, so it's important to keep training people and making people aware of what's happening. But a lot of people think that, you know, once people are rescued or leave the life or whatever, that it's over. But that deep trauma and control is a huge issue and really stays with people for a lifetime. So,
and also, what do they do after that? I mean, how do they get back to normal?
Well, that's what we're trying to do with Lionel Nay's house, and we won't really be helping all that many people at one time, but that's our effort. So, so that's the other thing that I realized is that, you know, for most people, you know, there's never a normal or getting back to a normal. Some of them have never had normalcy in their life to begin with. So, so there's not, you know, there's nothing to get back to. So when I first started, that's what I thought, you know, and that was why we chose the name Restoration Center, because we wanted to restore them. But so now I really hope that that the work that we do will help them to live the rest of their life the best they can with what they've experienced. So if we're able to do that, I think we'll be successful.
That was Sister Shirley Finneran, the Director of Field Education at Briarcliff University and a board member of the Siouxland Coalition Against Human Trafficking. Finneran will be talking about trafficking at the Conference on Trauma-Informed Communities next Friday at Sunnybrook Community Church in Sioux City. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, butterflies and ethanol don't seem like a natural match, but at a Northwest Iowa ethanol plant, there's a good-sized plot of land that's dedicated to the survival of monarch butterflies. Lakeview Plymouth Energy in Merrill has devoted 2 acres next to a creek on its property to milkweed plants. They first began growing 2 years ago. The idea is to provide a stop for the monarchs as they migrate across the country. Monarchs depend on milkweed because their larvae feed exclusively on the plant. There used to be a lot of milkweed around Iowa, but the expansion of farming and herbicides have made the plant scarce as time went on. Joe Williams is the manager of the Lakeview plant. He explains how and why the milkweed project began.
Well, what happened was, how this all began was, our CEO is president of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. So he gave me a call after a meeting and said, hey, they're starting this Monarch fueling station thing that they had going on down there. So he asked me if I'd be interested in it. He sent me some information, and it's something that we pursued pretty quickly. It's something that's very easy for us to do, and we decided to go ahead with it back in June of 2017.
So where are you at with it now?
Right now, it's actually got a year and a half growth on it. When you pulled in, you saw it on your left-hand side over there. It looks like it's overgrown and everything like that, because it's just not a mown. It's not mowed. It's that kind of land that's just got weeds growing on it. And one of those is milkweed that allow the monarch butterfly to put their larvae in there, which eats the milkweed, from my understanding. I'm not a biologist by any means. But that's what I've noticed, that's what I have read, that they consume the milkweed that's perfect for the monarch larva. And then they hatch and you have more monarchs.
Have you seen any monarchs around?
We have actually seen two. You know, it's a three-year process. We're not really anticipating too much growth until next year. But we have seen two monarchs. And our employees here, they are quick to point out, hey, this is what I saw out there. And they love seeing that. So, you know, they're the first ones to point out, hey, we just noticed a monarch out there. And we have seen two so far. We're hoping to see more next year when we're in the third year of growth.
Now, aren't there other stops?
There are, actually. There's several other ethanol plants who have participated in the Monarch refueling station with the IRFA. One of them, the only one other one that has planted so far that I'm aware of, is Lincoln Way Energy down in Nevada, Iowa. There are several other places that have committed to having growth, having plots. They've committed to having plots down there. And throughout the state, we'll get more and more. It's just land that we're dedicating to it that, hey, you plant once and that's it. You don't have to do any upkeep. It takes very little time for you to do this project, but it's very helpful to the environment. And it's something that it doesn't take anything for us to do.
I was just wondering, you know, because of the corn and the tariffs and all that, is there a difference, you know, between the kind of corn people might be selling, as, you know, the farmers are selling corn and worried about exporting the corn and the tariffs, but in the corn that you use? And it's kind of a dumb question, but does it affect you?
Oh, of course it does. The tariffs are definitely affecting us. They're affecting the farmers around here, whether it be from the cost of the materials that it takes to harvest them, or whether it be from the market. We've definitely seen that affected around here. There really is no difference between what we grind versus what is exported. There is no difference in the corn. But you can't say that ethanol doesn't just take the useless energy from the corn and make ethanol from it, but it also makes co-products that we use for a high protein feed for hogs, a nice wet cake for cattle as well around here. So rather than the corn going to feed animals, our products are feeding the animals instead, and we're taking something out of it that they don't need.
You know, 20, 30 years ago, the idea of trying to promote monarchs and something you could put in your car, gas you could put in your car, wouldn't seem to go together, but now it does.
With the farmers, they have to protect their crops. with the ethanol plants, we want to protect the environment. So we want to do our jobs. We want to do a good job in protecting the environments. We make a clean burning fuel to help with the environment. And we can only dedicate land to help out the environment around us as well.
That was Joe Williams, the manager of the Lakeview Plymouth Energy Plant in Merrill, just south of Lamar's. Williams continues to monitor milkweed plants that are part of the Monarch Fueling Station project, established by the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association to provide milkweed patches for monarch butterflies. So far, 8 of the IRFA's members have announced plans to start fueling stations for the monarchs, although only 2, Lakeview Plymouth and Lincoln Way Energy in Nevada, have planted milkweed so far. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Well, there's more good news environmentally, not just for the butterflies, as remnants from a June oil spill resulting from a train derailment in Lyon County continue to be taken to a Northwest Iowa landfill. Residents in a county initially concerned about the materials say they feel somewhat reassured. Officials from Dickinson County and BNSF Railway met last week to talk about the solid waste with minimal amounts of soil being transported from Lyon County to that Dickinson County landfill. County Board of Supervisors Chair Bill Leopold says he's feeling better about it since then.
Always tends to look on the dark side of things, but I am hopeful.
Landfill operator Waste Management says it doesn't accept waste containing any liquid at the landfill. A spokesman says they've been receiving more than 6 truckloads of derailment site waste each day. Dickinson County officials want a public meeting with environmental officials and the parties involved in the cleanup. BNSF expects to finish the cleanup this fall. And there's also good news about the so-called dead zone off the coast of Louisiana. It's much smaller than expected this year. After monitoring farm runoff from the Midwest, that has some researchers surprised and happy. This year's dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is about the size of the state of Delaware, half as big as scientists thought it would be, and less than a third the size it was in 2017. The hypoxia, or low oxygen zone in the Gulf, is linked to Midwestern farm field runoff, which spurs algae blooms and chokes out fish and shrimp. Even though the impact seems smaller this year, Eugene Turner at Louisiana State University says polluters are not off the hook.
Of course they're not, because we have a 5-year running average. And at least as from a science point of view, we've always said and continue to say that the environment itself is changing every year.
Though the hypoxic zone is smaller this year, Turner says he hasn't seen a significant decrease in nutrient runoff. And that's it for this week's edition of The Exchange. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. I'm Mary Hartnett.